We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
The following is intended for bizarre audiences only. Welcome to the Midnight Library.
Mr. Darling, you look dreadful. Did you eat a vegetarian?
I didn't get a wink of sleep. The lady gravediggers were having a dig and giggle fest right below my window last night.
Oh, that was the variants of the veil ritual. I didn't think you'd enjoy it.
Well, you might have invited me to see. What happens?
We dig up Aunt Vesta, douse her in blood, then replace her sacred veil.
Oh, sounds like a hoot. I demand to be included.
We do take her shopping for the veil first.
Ew, at the mall?
Yes.
Nope, I'm out.
Welcome! This way, everyone. Oh, don't you all look so divine? What beautiful living faces to have visiting us. We're just so fortunate to draw such appealing people. All plump and juicy. If you could all just scurry in, please, the entire group of you. Please enter the reading room together in a lively fashion. Go! Excuse me. Go on, please. That's right. Find your favorite spots. I'll be right along to entertain you in just a moment. I think Irma's done something unfortunate in the alcove, and I want to send for a maid. Mr. Darling, close the door behind our guest, won't you please?
Certainly, madam.
Count McCoy, you may come out now. Oh, my. You do look pale. How good of you to attend. What can we help you with? You want to make your eternal plans. You think you'd like to be buried here on the grounds of the library? What an honor! Yes. Oh, certainly. We have options for you. Oh, and you're a bit peckish. Yes, I see. I don't think we can have you sit for the reading with our regular visitors. Some of them are in costume, and you're not. Please follow Mr. Darling to our secluded balcony seating. It has a private view of the reading room, and you'll be able to view your very own hospitality tray below. Well, here I am. Thank you so much for herding yourselves in and getting comfy for tonight's offerings. Do my eyes deceive me, or am I seeing many of you elegantly attired in richly hued velvet and fine lace this evening? Oh, what a luscious sight to behold. My, my, my. Oh, welcome to the Midnight Library. I am your perfidious presenter, Miranda Merrick. Yes, I saw you eyeing the cart. Let me tell you what we have as sanguine sustenance for you this evening, which comes with just a wee caveat for those of you who happen to be delicate or squeamish when it comes to blood. Well, first off, wow. I mean, how lamentable that is, because tonight the hospitality tray is just dripping with all sorts of blood-based goodies. There's English blood sausage and blood pudding, Vietnamese pork blood porridge, Swedish blodplattar, or blood pancakes, and some imported Filipino dinuguan, which Natasha tells me is just a simple pork stew. Made by simmering raw intestines in bubbling blood and tangy vinegar until it congeals. Oh, some of you are beginning to flag just a little, I see. So, from all this talk of the beautiful red blood foods, so I'll just mention that there's also some plain, fruity, refreshing blood oranges on the tray, with monkey's blood clotted cream for extra iron, of course. I suspected you know that tonight's topic would draw a rather specific sort of crowd, and I do believe my suspicions were correct, because here you are. There's just something about vampires that makes them irresistible to us, isn't there? They have an allure or attraction, a power over our psyches. We want to know them, to hear their histories, let their lore wash over us. We long to understand their beastly compulsion. Some, it is said, dream of satiating them for some reason. But I'm sure that's none of us. Not intentionally, anyway. I'm sure. Besides, tonight's reading is on the compelling subject of vampire graves. So these bloodlusting creatures would already be dead. Well, undead. You know, let us begin. It is so interesting to me, my dear guests, that although the history of flesh-eating, blood-drinking monsters and demons goes back thousands of years in documented history, that within such early cultures as the Mesopotamians, the Hebrews, ancient Egyptians, Greeks, and Romans, these cultures didn't have, know, or even use a specific word that equates to the word vampire as we know the word today. Most etymological sources we have here state that the origin of the unique and lovely word, vampire, is derived from Turkish or very old Slavic languages and was first spoken like upir, with a U and a P, as in a pentagram, or ubir, with a U and a B, as in black magic. The word ubir, amazingly enough, meant witch. Later, the word lengthened into onpir, and the Hungarians bent that into vampire, which was pronounced wampir, with a W, as in witch. Isn't that a fascinating circle with a big old star in the middle? The French then smartly sharpened vampire into vampire, which nicely evolved into having the definition of an undead being who drinks the blood of the living. Did I ever tell you I have a French grandmother? Now you know. I also want to include the delicious fact that Nosferatu, very early on, was the Romanian word for vampire. And no one truly knows where the word Nosferatu came from. Delicious! First, we'll have just a little actual living vampire history before we absorb all of the yummy dead stuff. Partake of the grave lore or whatever. And here I have to say, my lovelies, that for a being that is said to be fictitious, there are simply countless numbers of vampire graves dotted all over this lonely planet of ours. So that's curious, isn't it? Vampires, it seems, are a world phenomenon. Their most well-known history emanates, of course, from Europe, from two also well-known sources. One being the lore of maniacal warriors, most notably Vlad the Impaler, who in the 1400s was the military governor and prince of Wallachia in Romania. He was known for fiercely defending his people from the imposing Ottoman Empire and violently retaliating for the death of his father, Vlad Dracul, which was the Latin name for dragon. Vlad made it a blatant point to warn his enemies of what fate they would face if they challenged him, by impaling his adversaries' heads and bodies on tall, rough-hewn stakes, jammed into the grounds of his battlefields. And not just 10 or 20 or even 100 dead and dying men drooping on poles, which may well have been shocking warning enough. Oh no. In 1462, Vlad the Impaler left sprawling acres, a steaming, blood-misted battlefield with thousands of impaled victims, a veritable forest of skewered, punctured, and spiked men hanging and dangling from their blood-streaked, sharpened poles. The ground, a wet mire of red mud. Some historical notes claim that he drank the blood of his gored enemies, earning him the title of vampire. Whether or not this citation of Vlad the Impaler as a vampire is 100% accurate is still in contention today. The second source of rampant vampire lore is their graves. Toward the end of the Middle Ages, many countries around the world were headed for the Great Renaissance, a time of gaining true knowledge and doing away with superstitions and the putting away of old beliefs. But in many places around the world, this new way of thinking was, well, still a long ways away. Proof of this has been found in modern times, and in shocking fashion. Only a little more than 10 years ago, in Gliwice, Poland, digging construction workers accidentally plowed up an ancient cemetery. Now, this in itself isn't terribly unusual, but it was the way these dead were buried that was so disturbing. Now, I know that given what I've just told you, well, you may already be envisioning a distant, lonely field with neatly arranged forgotten graves, with fine and familiar old wooden rectangular caskets and angle-topped coffins being lifted up and unearthed by a reckless bulldozer, and the freshly exhumed skeletons tumbling out of them in their centuries-old tattered suits and gowns. And while that is a pretty vision to imagine, that is not what these workmen found. These unprepared workers found mass graves with broken and jagged bones caught up in their digging equipment. These dead had no caskets of any kind, and they wore no garments at all. They were just sets of muddy, bare bones resting down in the earth. When the digging was halted and archaeologists' officials were called in, they easily surmised that what the excavators had found was a vampire burial ground. How did they know this? It's not that each of the numerous dead had a sharp set of fangs in their head, but the clue did lie in the skulls of each of the soil-encrusted sets of remains. It was the location of their heads that made it all so obvious. Before these dead were laid out in their pit, each of the dead person's heads had been hacked from their necks and purposefully placed between their knees. It was believed by people in the 15th and 16th centuries that separating the head from the body of a known vampire would prevent them from rising from their graves to resume terrorizing and draining the blood from the living. More plainly, since it was thought that vampires remained undead even after their apparent deaths, head removal was done to truly stop them. Our lovely old tome here also notes that sometimes a slightly less choppy action was sometimes employed, but it resulted in the same outcome. They, people in the past, would simply hang the vampire by his or her neck and just leave them to the elements until one day the rope rotted or the vertebrae separated and their head just popped off naturally. Maybe we should have a little break. Tonight's reading in the Midnight Library is happily brought to you by the League of Lady Gravediggers. The ladies know a special way to meet a vampire's needs. They dig shallow, easy graves, free of rocks and weeds. They know that sucker needs to rise and spring up from the dirt, then jump back in before sunrise when all the veins have spurt. The ladies offer special digs, like a swing door mausoleum, room enough to dance a jig, out and back before you see 'em. Big Lou knows a thing or two about a thirsty ghoul. She once built Nosferatu, a bloody waiting pool. Penny's just as smart, she knows what vamps are starving for. Her crypts are easy to depart. They have revolving doors, Mindy's very nice, you know. To vamps who've lived and died. She installs pet doors down below so their rats can come inside. Keep your victims fresh, they say, and drained before they've riggered. Book your trapdoor grave today and call the Lady Grave Diggers. If you know or are a vampire looking for ease and convenience in your sunset years, the League of Lady Gravediggers has just the crypt for you. All caskets have soft closed doors and all chambers lock from the inside only. Book your burial before dawn and get a free mud rug to keep your coffin clean. All burials are guaranteed. No light leaks, no door creaks, no vamp freaks. And you safe inside for eternity. Maybe. Call 976-DITCH-WITCHES. Now, my lovelies, I do believe you'll find it so very interesting that those who were so certain that vampires were in their midst so long ago, well, they often thought of more than just grisly forms of head removal as a method of keeping a dead vampire dead. They had alternative ways as well. Thinking on it just now, what in modern times we would deem as abuse of a corpse? Well, those who truly believed they were burying vampires would have labeled it life insurance for the living. Potato, potato, I guess. One such alternative example is that of the 16th century grave of a young French woman who was buried during a plague. By all accounts, most everything about her burial was typical, except her skinless skeleton had wedged into its gaping mouth a large rectangular gray brick, powerfully hammered back into her jaws, smashing into her molars, and permanently wedging her mouth open for eternity. This gruesome after-death act was a sure sign that in life, this woman presented some clear indication, whatever it was, that caused those around her to firmly believe that she was an undead vampire. The thick brick, intended as a tool to keep her from biting forever. In other times, the body of a suspected vampire might be treated in a more violent manner by being staked to the ground, running the corpse through with a stake made of metal or wood in order to pin it to its burial ground. In 2012, archaeologists in Bulgaria found two such skeletons with iron rods driven through their chests, a clear sign that they were believed to be bloodthirsty vampires. Another quite young woman's skeleton, buried for 400 years in Poland, was found with a heavy triangular padlock around her big toe in an attempt to keep her anchored to her grave in some way. As backup, though, across her teenage throat, her barriers inserted a sickle's handle deep into the ground beside her neck, which perfectly positioned the curve of the razor-sharp blade directly above her youthful throat, thus ensuring she behead herself the moment she attempted to rise to hunt. Just to play devil's advocate for a moment, if you're wondering what sorts of behavior or happenings these people could present that would cause others to accuse them of vampirism. Other than out and out biting the blood out of someone, there really were a few things. Vampires, in addition to being blood-sucking ghouls, were also thought to be a source of plagues and pestilence. So, if you were new in town, and suddenly your neighbor's crops failed, well, you might be thought to be the cursed vampire who brought the bedevilment of food failure with you. Another more vivid sign that someone was a vampire was actually just a misunderstood symptom of being very ill. People with consumption back then, or tuberculosis now, a severe and deadly respiratory illness, had the alarming and gory symptom of coughing up blood. When they did this, folks around them assumed that they had been drinking the blood of others and coughing it up, when in fact, their inflamed and damaged lungs were bringing forth their own blood. They weren't monsters, but they were suffering. In modern times, it should be noted that the tuberculosis infection is still a rampant and airborne contagion. It's also curable. It's just that the testing for and the treatment of or cure of tuberculosis is often sadly kept out of reach of those in the poorest and most affected areas. It's a crime against humanity. But one of the most likely diseases that sealed the fate of the stricken was porphyria. Porphyria saddled its victims with cruel symptoms that became so prolific, they framed the outline of every piece of vampire lore that gave way to and filled countless novels, screenplays, lyrics, and poems. Briefly, porphyria is a serious blood disorder that disrupts the production of hemoglobin, the key component in red blood cells. The disease damages the blood cells' ability to carry oxygen from the lungs to the rest of the entire body. Porphyria causes extreme sensitivity to sunlight, the face to wildly contort, and the gums to recede, exposing more of the teeth in general, but emphasizing the canines in a manner that causes them to look like fangs. People with porphyria soon learned that the sulfur contained in garlic could bring on or exacerbate the already painful indications of the illness. The sick person would hide away from the public and avoid seeing their own hideous images in windows and mirrors. They also steered clear of Christian churches, who were known to crucify and or burn vampires. So, in the end, you had a person who looked ghastly and only went out at night with their lips and gums drawn back to expose their fangs, and was repulsed by garlic and vehemently avoided mirrors and crucifixes. And voila! A vampire is born, so to speak. Admittedly, it is a compelling and curious history lesson to hear of all of these burials and bones from the old country, as our grandparents were wont to say. But, my lovelies, there is a fresher grave once thought to contain a vampire in more modern times, in America. I give you the forlorn tale of Mercy Brown. In the village of Exeter, Rhode Island, in the late 19th century, there lived a young family, a humble farmer, George Brown, with his wife Mary, and their 7 children. Consumption by this time had now come to be known alternatively as tuberculosis. But understanding the disease to any degree of complexity was still a long ways off. People understood that they had the disease, but they didn't know how it was spread. The lore and conspiracy of vampires hiding in the midst of the living had been imported from Europe and still had its grip on the naive public's imaginations. In 1883, the mother of the family, Mary, was the first to die. She was 35 years old. The following year, 20-year-old daughter, Mary Olive, died. A few years later, in 1889, the Browns' only son, Edward, began to show signs of the illness, but it did stabilize somewhat. In 1892, daughter Mercy Lena Brown became sick. She quickly declined and died on January 17th at the age of 19. With 3 beloved members of his family now dead from the mysterious ailment and his only son fading, George Brown was desperate for direction. No doctor could save anyone if their condition worsened. But the country folk had a suggestion for George. Suggestion may not be the right word here. The country folk pressured George, hounded him into returning to the old ways. They told him the only way to save what was left of his family was to dig up the 3 dead members of his family, find which one was the true vampire, and destroy them. With nowhere else to turn, George and a few others began digging. His wife, Mary, and his daughter, Mary Olive, had obediently turned to bare bones. But Mercy showed almost no decay. More damning was the fact that her face was rosy and her lips were red with blood. When they split her open, her heart and lungs were full of fine, dark red blood. It should be noted here that neither George nor the town physician were convinced that anything was out of the ordinary. The most fiery believers of the old lore still persuaded George that if he wanted to save the life of his son, there was only one way to do it. They cut out Mercy's heart and lungs and burned them black. Then they made a concoction of the burnt organ's ashes mixed with water and gave it to the ill teenager to drink. He still died 2 months later in 1892. 3 more of George Brown's daughters would die in 1895, leaving only one, his 5th child, Hattie, to escape the other's fate. Let us do a little amateur sleuthing here, shall we? If you were to take a stab at the reason that it all looked so convincing that poor young Mercy Brown was the family vampire, what would you say was the reason? Why were her remains so drastically different from those of her mother and sister? Better embalming? No, none of them were embalmed in these times. I do think some of you may have guessed it. It was down to timing, my dear guests. Yes, Mother Mary Brown and daughter Mary Olive died years earlier and in the warmer part of the year, and so were buried down in the soft ground where they had time to naturally decompose. Mercy had died only 8 weeks before they exhumed her, and her body had been stored in an above-ground crypt where it froze. They had planned to give her a proper burial in the spring, after the rock-hard, frozen ground had thawed. So, when she was removed from her crypt, she looked nearly exactly the same as when they had put her in it. The entire burial plot for the Brown family is still there for anyone who would like to respectfully visit and reflect on the tragedy that this family suffered. I would like to emphasize the word respectfully because, unbelievably, Mercy Brown's lovely old tombstone has had to be secured to the ground with heavy iron bands and rods due to miserable, wretched idiots who've tried numerous times to steal it. But I know that you will be loving and kind, leaving only stones or flowers and hallowed thoughts. Thank you for respecting the dead, vampire or not. Now, if you will all rise and find Mr. Darling at the back of the... Yeah. Yes, Miss Mina. Yes? Can I make an announcement for you? Maybe. Huh? You. Oh, I see. Certainly. Amazing. Everyone, Miss Mina is working for the village blood drive, and she's looking for both an assistant and some plump volunteers. What a coincidence. I'm sure many of you will be happy to donate. And Miss Mina, if you'll stay behind here with me, I have someone I'd like you to meet. Yes, you're the open-minded sort, right? Excellent. Good night, my dear guests. Good night.
Well, everyone, good night. Don't let the vampires bite. Madam, I've just seen the most amazing thing. Count McCoy actually had his arm around Miss Mina as they departed the grounds. They've only just met.
Yes, that's vampire charm, darling. It works faster than magic.
You sound a bit jealous.
You sound a bit jealous.
Well, what do we do now?
Double Bloody Marys at the Broom and Fang.
Let me get my hat. And a new curse poppet.
Yes.
The Midnight Library would like to thank everyone at Astonishing Legends. The magical music and sound design you hear is by Chris at Sounds Like an Earful. All of our readings are written and produced by me, Miranda Merrick. My favorite thing is sharing them with you. If you have found joy and terror by visiting our unique library, I invite you to join me beyond the cordoned off areas in our also unique Patreon.
I solemnly swear on a stack of ancient grimoires that I will personally greet you there, and that you can reach me anytime you care to write. Our patrons get everything first. Visit patreon.com/midnightlibrary. If Patreon doesn't give you shivers, please find lots of strange goodies and buy us a bag of entrails in our Ko-fi at ko-fi.com/midnightlibrarypod. Be sure to put pod on the end or you'll land on a boring copycat. If you already support the Midnight Library, well, you already know how much we love you. Thank you.